thank you so much for calling in to WRSU FM New Brunswick, John.
Hi.
Alrighty. I wanted to ask you actually a couple questions. You know, your band has been around for over 3 decades, but I want to focus on you as a person more so than the band and its music. I just want to ask you, because I have a friend that I've known for many, many years. We're living together. We're living together next year. And you and John L. have been inseparable, it seems, for well over 3 decades. You know, not only making music, but sometimes living together. What do you think exactly is the key to such a long-lasting friendship?
Oh, you know, well, I mean, we do give each other a lot of space. I mean, a lot of personal space and even a lot of, like, sort of professional space. I think, you know, what's funny is that, like, you don't, when you're kids, like, respecting one another doesn't seem like a very important part of a friendship. But it has definitely, I think it's definitely, like, I think our regard for each other's, like, ability to sort of do excellent work has kind of grown and grown, you know. I think it's good that way. I mean, we had a lot of shared experiences as kids that would be, like, the kind of experiences that people would have as, like, brothers would have. Like, we saw a lot of shows together as teenagers. There was a group of friends of ours who all worked on the high school newspaper together, and we all had, like, fake IDs, and we would drive into Boston on, like, you know, in somebody's parents' cars on, like, weekends and often on weekdays, and just see these very cheap kind of punk rock shows at the Rathskeller and these other places in Boston. And, you know, we saw all sorts of different shows, and it was very formative. And we saw a lot of movies and experienced a lot of cultural things right in that sort of mid-70s moment. And it was very formative. And I think, like, our takes on things, it's hard to say how much, like, we influenced one another and how much sort of, like, just having the shared experience, you know, helped us sort of form a unified thing. But I think that's one of the reasons why it's been so easy, is because we're not, you know, when you look at a lot of bands, they're kind of people sort of smashed together from very disparate backgrounds. And it's, you know, if something happens for them, then it kind of binds them together, but might not have that solid a foundation. For us, you know, it was very easy. I mean, we were friends before we were in a band, and then the band, you know, just going through everything we went through with the band. And we've also been very lucky in that, like, we haven't had things, like, pulling us apart.
You know, at the start of it, when you only had 2 people in the band, it wasn't like one of you could leave the band necessarily and the drum machine could take over. So it's almost like you were stuck together at the very beginning.
Yeah, but, you know, I mean, the way the star-making machinery works, it's very anti-duo. I can tell you, like, the duo thing is sort of a rare. I mean, they definitely are not interested in groups that work, like, you know, as democracies. Like, they definitely want, like, the front person. They sort of tolerate duos, but I think, you know, in a lot of cases, people would really rather just have there be one person be the front person.
I was watching a couple older television shows, and in one of the shows, they refer to you as the John with the glasses. I felt like that was a little bit of an undermining to you, because you're John. You are John. That's who you are as a person.
Oh, no, I'd rather people say I'm the John with the glasses than I'm the fat one.
Oh,
yeah. So, you know, I mean, it's all relative, but yeah, it's also kind of, I mean, I guess it's sort of a thing that we're both named John, but, you know, the year we were born, you know, John F. Kennedy was elected president. There were a lot of kids named John.
That's kind of morbid that the parents would.
Well, they didn't know he was going to die.
Oh, I thought it was post-dying. They're like, oh, no, John F. Kennedy.
No. He was the Obama of his time.
Right.
Extremely popular. When I was in third grade, I think there were like 7 out of 13 boys in my class, 7 of them were named John.
Mm-hmm.
Like, insane.
Did some of them go by Johnny? Did you go by Johnny at one point?
No.
No?
No, you just, people, the thing that people would always do is they would always say, use their last initial. So it would be like John F., John L. That would be like the thing.
Do you think that the glasses define you, or you define the glasses?
You know, I've worn glasses for so long, I can't even separate it.
Yeah, I couldn't find any photos of you without the glasses.
Yeah, I feel like I look weird without them, but I probably don't. But you know, it's just like if you wear glasses all the time, you just feel like you look like an egg if you're not wearing your glasses.
Too round. When talking glasses fashion exactly, what do you think is important?
Oh, I don't know. You know, I mean, there's a lot of different ways to do it. I was a friend of mine started dating this woman who wore the most plain-looking aviator glasses, like they were straight out of like 1978, and seemed very, very dowdy to me. And it took me a little while. It took a number of sort of, and these were not like, you know, we would just sort of have a cocktail, meet up for something, and then we'd be off. So I didn't really get to know her for a little while, and I realized at some juncture that she actually was totally rocking a normcore thing, which I don't know if you're familiar with. Are you familiar with the style normcore?
Normcore is like dressing like a dad, isn't that like it? Kind of like that?
No.
No.
No, it's not dressing like a dad. It's much closer to, do you remember the movie, I'm trying to remember, it was a Spike Jonze movie, I believe it was called Her?
Yeah, Her. I know Her.
Do you remember, like, it's set in some indeterminate point in the near future,
mm-hmm.
like, not clear whether it's, like, 2025 or 2030, but it's like, you know, it's sort of in the future.
Mm-hmm.
And everyone is wearing basically normcore clothes.
Undefined almost, right?
It's like very neutral style. It sort of looks like corporate clothes, like pants are like the hems of like a pant leg will be like slightly high, and everything's very straight legged, and yeah, it just looks very sort of 1984 K car kind of Sears catalog clothes.
Right.
And I mean, I have to say, like, if you really embrace normcore, it's a pretty subversive way of going about like attacking your fashion sensibility, because it's like it just seems like there's nothing happening at all. You know, it's just like it's so boring. It's bizarre. I mean, most people dress to make and give people an impression, or like identify with a subculture, or you know, just say something about themselves, or you know, fit in. But to like to dress in like a boring way in order to distinguish yourself or to stand apart from the crowd seems really crazy.
How would you describe exactly your fashion sensibilities then, if you want to avoid this kind of boring, mundane, but it's almost absurd in how mundane it is, like that it's interesting. You are correct there, but how would you define your fashion sensibilities?
Oh, well, I mean, you know, I dress pretty conservatively. I'm from New England. I grew up with like very preppy clothes. And so like, I think just my default is, you know, pretty much on that same, you know, I never thought about it that much.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I kind of dress like my dad, so in a way, I'm rocking my own normcore vibe.
Right. Yeah. It's almost retro. You're looking back to your dad.
I wear a lot of Oxford shirts. You know, I wear sneakers every day. I don't know. I'm not really like when you're younger. It's like, you know, that, you know, fashion identity means so much more. You know, now that I'm now that I'm old, it all just seems like just a big, big old bunch of posturing.
You don't look a day over 40. Don't worry. Don't worry.
I got to get your mirror.
I want to transition very quickly to your directing career, because you directed some of my favorite bands, favorite songs, actually. You directed the music video Private Helicopter by Harvey Danger.
I did. Yeah. That was a very fun one. Yeah. I mean, I had some sort of odd experiences doing video directing. A lot of times, because it was a very odd time. It was a very high stakes time for rock video when I kind of entered the scene as a director. And so the record companies were very, very hands-on and kind of nervous and sort of unfortunate. Like, a lot of things really got dismantled and destroyed by the record companies. But there wasn't much else to do because you're just kind of serving their whims. But it was frustrating, ultimately, just having... Seeing over and over again things kind of get re-edited and changed around. There were some very, fun, creative projects that just got kind of undermined. I mean, I think specifically like of the video that I did for Ben Folds just got like completely ruined by the record company. I don't think Ben Folds even ever saw the original edit of the video. And I did a video for Edwin Collins that was like really interesting and stylish, but again, it was like for a movie, so it was like a little bit of a strange, when you're doing a video for a movie, like half the budget's coming from the movie promo side of things, so they just shove like an incredible amount of movie footage into what you're doing. And it really took some of the vibe, there's only so much Liv Taylor I can, film cuts I can live with in a rock video.
Mm-hmm. In Song for the Dumped, I wanted to mention that because I also had that you directed that down. Was it your decision or the record company's decision to include that little Japanese section in the middle?
They wanted to shoot, there was a Japanese version of the song,
mm-hmm.
So they shot a video in Japanese and a video in English.
Oh, I've never seen the Japanese version. It's not available on YouTube.
It might not have ever gotten finished.
Oh.
It might have just been that way. But there was a lot of, radical stuff that, again, sort of ended up on the cutting room floor. There's a whole doll scenario in it that really needed continuity to make sense, to not just be like decoration. And what happened is that continuity basically got demolished. It got sort of disassembled very quickly, and so it doesn't track.
And you talked about studio meddling really just kind of messing up these bands. And just circling back to Harvey Danger, the Private Helicopter never impacted radio stations the same way Flagpole Sitta ever did. And Ben Folds 5, same idea. Song for the Dumped, maybe not radio friendly, but none of their other songs really impacted radios quite as much as Brick did. Why exactly do you think that radio stations and listeners in the 90s were so welcoming of these alternative musicians and then kind of nonchalantly toss so many aside without another minor hit?
Oh, well, I mean, I think I don't think that's unique to the 90s. I think it's, when I think of, I mean, this is a very sort of abstract conversation.
Mm-hmm.
I just recently had, over Christmas, I actually had a Christmas meal with the guy who ran Hits magazine. And it was the big radio action magazine of the 90s. So it was like the insider's billboard.
Mm-hmm.
And so we were talking about this kind of thing. There's a really big difference between a song and a hit to those people. And they really aren't you know, people who are into radio and people who are into hits, which seems anachronistic now, but, like, you know, I mean, they were the industry leaders. I mean, those are the really hard-charging people who, you know, made really big things out of very small ideas. And to them, those differences, what might seem like shades of gray to us were, like, very, very meaningful. I mean, to me, the biggest example of, like, a band that could have, you know, easily have been a two-hit wonder rather than a one-hit wonder was D-Light. There was a song on their album called Good Beat that kind of had, it was a, sort of a housey kind of sounding track, which in its moment was actually a little bit ahead of its time. And it was extraordinarily catchy. But the truth is, and this is sort of like circles back to maybe like a small man theory of history, which is to say that, like, personal interactions can weigh into events just as much as, you know, what seem like, you know, bigger concerns. I think that they blew up so fast and were, like, so complicated to work with as a band that they just lost a lot of their allies at the label. And I think they people were just like, Grooves in the Heart's great, but, you know, they're not gonna, you know, play the game. So next.
When you're directing a video, what do you think is your signature John Flansburgh style?
I'm really not trying to beat myself up, but, like, you know, when we started making videos, when we were, like, collaborating with Adam Bernstein directed, like, all the first half dozen videos or so, it was such a different time in terms of what the destination of the video was and what it meant culturally. I mean, one thing that was very clear to us was that videos that had scenarios were scanned as extremely phony, which is a really weird idea, because, I mean, almost all visual communication, like, you know, whether it's, you know, a TV commercial or a TV show or a movie or whatever, you know, they're vignettes, they're storytelling, there's some kind of continuity. And it seemed like the promise of rock videos was that it just, like, smashed the whole idea of like, sort of linear storytelling and just turned, it was a purely sort of sensational visual medium that was, you know, just really exciting to watch, you know, and it just kind of came at you. It sort of had almost, it was all, essentially psychedelic. You know, it was just you know, contrasting these different things. And, you know, as somebody who was coming out of art school and working with somebody who had as bold a style as Adam, you know, we found a lot of common ground as to how to approach, you know, specific videos. Like, for instance, like in the Don't Let's Start video, it's never officially stated, but everything is going in circles. Like the whole, all the, you know, we were riffing on the idea of, like, it having this sort of, like, you know, circular motion. And there are a lot of things that sort of work that way in the video. And that simple, unified approach helped make it very successful. And, you know, there are a lot of other things in there that are just, that, you know, stood out, the fact that it was shot on film, the fact that it was, you know, overcranked by double, you know, and it was black and white. All those things in many ways sort of harken back to, like, A Hard Day's Night, which for a lot of people is, like, their most pleasant rock music video experience. So, you know, I mean, reintroducing the funsy onesiness of A Hard Day's Night, it hardly seems like a revolutionary act. But at the time, you know, given this sort of, you know, the weird sort of nickel and dime surrealism of videos in general, it
unless we forget the shawarma hats that you're wearing and Don't Let's Start.
Oh, yeah.
Whatever happened to the shawarma hats? Do you, like, still have them? Do you store them somewhere?
Well, they were essentially two-dimensional objects that I just carried around in a portfolio case. All they were was just, like, a piece of a very thick cardstock, and then there was a bolt of fabric, duct taped on one side, and then, like, sort of, tight, and then there's Velcro running along the end of it, and then you kind of put it on your head and kind of curled it around and then Velcroed it tight in the back, and it just so it was sort of snugly fit on your head. Everything we did with props in the early years of the band was essentially two-dimensional objects that turned into three-dimensional objects, so we could cart them around.
Yeah, that's fascinating. I always thought it was a cone of sorts.
Well, it is. I mean, it was just a piece of cardstock turned into a cone.
Oh, okay.
And then the way it sat on our heads was just like the pressure of how tight it was.
Were you trying to make that your calling card, in a sense, that people would see the hat first and then they'd hear the music and stay for the music, essentially?
Well, you know, we came up in New York City. We came up in this performance art scene that was very visually oriented, and there was a lot of things kind of jumping out at people. So it's kind of a chicken and egg thing. I mean, we were definitely, you know, trying to get attention, but I mean, we weren't really preoccupied with presenting ourselves as being cool. So it's like, you know, once you're free of that, there's a lot of things you can do that are pretty interesting. I don't know. I mean, you know, we weren't the weirdest thing around, that's for sure.
With so many music videos coming out now for They Might Be Giants, and with the music video brand of you guys being so ubiquitous, who oversees the production and the approval of all these new music videos?
We, in the past couple of, in 2015 and 2018, we've run a dial-a-song program where we post a new song every week, and we try to have an accompanying video with every song that gets posted. So obviously, the production value of these things has got to be sort of under control, because we don't have a huge budget for, I mean, we don't really have any budget for videos, let alone a big one. So it's a pretty scrappy enterprise trying to figure out how to create visual content to accompany these songs. We've been lucky to find a group of some graphic designers, some animators, some illustrators who, you know, sort of help us with that heavy lifting. And so a lot of it is really just, you know, me and John keeping our eyes out for interesting illustrators doing stuff out there. And the fact that laptop animation, flash animation, is easier to, you know, or working in After Effects is a lot easier to do on a home computer than it used to be, has really helped us kind of keep the ball rolling visually.
A super fan on Medium.com, going by the name Ekel Emkchi, I can't even pronounce it, he ranked every single one of your videos, I believe, in 2017, so it's not every single video, but he says your top three are, and this is in descending order from 3, 2, 1, Birdhouse in Your Soul, then I'm Impressed, and then at the very bottom, at number one, is Spoiler Alert. Do you agree with this? What do you feel? And it's a very interesting choice that Spoiler Alert, you know, one of the newer songs, you would expect people to kind of wax nostalgic and kind of put Birdhouse in Your Soul
down
there. So I was pleasantly surprised. I mean, do you agree with this?
Well, Spoiler Alert was a very, very simple video. I mean, I was just thinking back, like, I guess technically I directed that video. That video was the third video shot in one day at Pat Dillett's studio on 37th Street. We did the video for Cloisonné, which was kind of like the big production one. I'm pretty sure that Spoiler Alert was really like the very simple. There's a thing in video production where you start with like the biggest setup that you've got, and then you sort of work your way down. And I just remember by the time we did Spoiler Alert, like everyone was like so exhausted. You know, it was just like everybody had been going for like 7 or 8 hours straight. You know, there had been like a pizza break for a half hour or something, but everyone was just like so bleary eyed. It was hard to really focus everybody up.
What would you say was your favorite music video to make? I understand that this was an 8 hour day, so maybe not that one.
Like, I mean, these days my role in the video production stuff is much closer. I used to work as like a photo editor at a magazine, and that, you know, it's kind of like an art direction job. So it's essentially curatorial. I don't want to take, the animated videos that happen, you know, we definitely consult on and sort of help steer in very fundamental ways, including like putting teams of people together. But like we just recently did this Cassandra, this is one of the last videos of the year for Mrs. Bluebeard. And, you know, she has a very different kind of style than anything we've ever done. And I thought she did a really great job. And, you know, I got to work with her all through the sort of storyboarding process. And she, you know, came up with these very extreme ideas that I thought were really interesting and kind of cool, and all in a sort of commercial art style of like 50s kind of female, almost like perfume ad or fashion illustration style. And that seemed very cool. And it was great to be able to get David Coles and Jeremy Galanti, the guys who animated it, on board, because I've done a million things with them, and they know our scene really well. So it was great working with people that I'm very familiar with working with on something that had a very distinctly different sensibility.
I'd also say The Communists Have the Music kind of seemed like a very different kind of music video to me.
Again, you know, the same animator, but a different illustrator sort of at the helm of the look. That was this guy David Plunkett, who does a lot of New Yorker covers. He did that famous Trump sailboat with the Klan hat as the sail of a sailboat, with Trump blowing it with his, you know, providing the all the air to the sail.
right.
It was, you know, he's a fantastic illustrator. He's got this very specific style that is very, very strong, and is sort of, you know, jumping off of like Russian constructivist stuff. I mean, the thing that was tricky about The Communists Have the Music video is that we were running up against, there's a great, you know, a great video by Franz Ferdinand that probably cost like $1 million that is in a similar style. So it was, a lot of the decision making was like, how do we not just have people go like, well, this is a really crummy version of the Franz Ferdinand thing, but it's all based on this, you know, very sort of circa 1925 look.
So I found this common theme. You said in an interview with Jon Stewart that you're like Trotsky in the group. You came out with the song The Communists Have the Music, and then you also have a song, Kiss Me, Son of God, which is kind of, I always felt, was kind of about Joseph Stalin, maybe reading into lines a bit more.
I think Linnell said that I was.
Oh, yes, yes,
Trotsky.
Yes. You're right. But where does this communist love go? How far does this communist love go? Where does it stem from, exactly?
Oh, well, you know, it seems like sort of like a Turetic kind of thing to say, in a way. I mean, it's, people pick on communists a lot, you know, even though they seem sort of historically irrelevant at this point. I don't know. It's an interesting, the thing that's strange to me, well, there's just so many things that are strange to me about the whole idea of communism. You know, it's funny to me that it's the one that people just dismiss out of hand, when it seems like they're really people are really open to giving fascism a second chance.
You know, I think you're better than the communists, John, because your music, it's a domino effect, just like the communists, in a way. My friend Daniel was listening to them, then I started listening to them, then my friend John started listening to them, and it just went on and on and on. And one day, the entire world will be dominated by your music. Who knows?
Well, I certainly hope so.
Now, before I go, I just want to ask one last question, and it's a little bit out of left field, I feel, because you had a role on Xavier Renegade Angel, and I love that show. I just want to know, how did you land your role as the computer on that show?
Hold on one sec. Oh, it was my friend John Lee, who I actually wrote a song called John Lee Super Taster about him. He is an actual super taster. But he was the director and creator of that show with his friend Vernon, and John's wife, Allison, was the producer, and they just called me up and said, you know, can you come in and do just like do this small role? And the thing that was really shocking about it was they really wanted, I mean, the show is not afraid of being kind of grotesque, and on a personal level, it's weird to sort of throw yourself into the deep end of the ugliness pool. I mean, I think most people have enough vanity that they don't want to just, you know, put on some super frightening costume. But and I include myself in that group. But the thing that was super weird about it was they wanted to reproduce either like the Mickey Rooney Japanese stereotype or like some Jerry Lewis Japanese stereotype costume, like a real sort of like broad, ultra racist 50s, like, ah, so, like, you know, like very, very disturbingly out of date stereotype costume. And I was fully freaked out by the idea. Like, I was nothing had prepared me to be sort of trying to, like, walk, you know, kind of talk this thing down. And, you know, when you kind of go into a production and somebody's got a very bold and crazy idea that you don't agree with, you're just kind of, you off, this is not unfamiliar territory for me, but like, you know, you're in a room of people who are all like, no, it's going to be great. And you're just the only person there going like, this seems like a terrible idea. So, you know, small modifications were made. Hopefully, I mean, it's still very, very upsetting, but hopefully it doesn't scan as frightening as it seemed like it was going to be.
I always scanned it more as like a Max Headroom kind of character, more so than anything.
The edit is very Max Headroom, which I understood, and I think they knew I could deliver the sort of materials to build that up from. That I totally got, but it was the racial stuff that was more, seems like more on thin ice.
Definitely, definitely. I have a question from my friend Evan, who is a huge fan. Lightning round question, so to speak. What are your favorite emerging bands in the alternative and indie scene right now?
Well, you know, a couple of radio interviews ago, I was just talking casually with the DJ, and she mentioned Ty Segall. And I was talking about how much I enjoyed Ty Segall. And I'm not like, you know, some encyclopedic super fan, but I have a bunch of his recordings. I actually have a couple of vinyl things of Ty Segall. So I'm kind of into the Ty Segall side of things. But, you know, I think I'm like a lot of people with Spotify. I do a lot of like grazing of contemporary stuff and, you know, don't necessarily dig that deep into it. Like, you know, I'll often hear a song that I just really enjoy, and that's And I don't go much farther into finding out that much about the band, which is, you know, seems like kind of a shallow thing to do, but that's, you know, that's sort of the world of Spotify, I guess.
Is that the reason why you're not going to be releasing your new Dial-A-Song compilation albums on Spotify?
It's hard to say. I mean, basically, the truth is by... I don't know how forthcoming I should be on this. It's sort of nobody's business but ours. But the truth is, we don't really make a lot of money off of Spotify.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we've been doing this for like a long, long time, and you know, I feel like, you know, we found that we can, you know, we have a lot of output. We can do things more than one way, and so this round we're just kind of foregoing the streaming sites, and. You know, consequently, we're selling a lot of records and CDs and downloads. And that's, you know, that helps us, you know, carry on. So we're just, you know, I guess we're no different than any other band. We're just trying to kind of make a living at what we're doing. And it's a drag not to be able to feel like, you know, put everything up for free. But we put up a lot of stuff for free.
One of the first ways I experienced They Might Be Giants was on a long car ride with your CD compilation album, the one with the ant on it. It was like the finger and the ant.
Oh, right, right. The early years, I believe. It's Dial-A-Song.
Yeah.
It's called Dial-A-Song.
Mm-hmm.
It was the Rhino compilation.
I definitely feel like that's one of the better ways to experience your band is in context with the other songs. Because when you just hear one song, I don't think you can really get an idea of the depth and the diversity to They Might Be Giants.
I think that for a long time that was something that we were really trying to promote, is this sort of idea of like They Might Be Giants kind of being its own musical universe. There's a band, The Residents, that we were very influenced by, and one of the things about The Residents were, you know, very distinct band, but there was a quality to what they did that really felt like you were in their world when you listened to their albums. But lots of bands are like that. I mean, that's a great way to sort of, that full immersion thing of listening to an album or listening to a big, long compilation, I think that's a great way to get into a band.
And one last question, just because, going back to Spotify, back in the early 2000s, you did a They Might Be Giants Unlimited collection, and those are not on Spotify, and you know, some of the songs did appear on other albums like Mink Car, but the rest or a large majority are not on Spotify. Will those ever be released on Spotify?
One of the big issues that has come up over the years that's really a drag is that all the people who insisted that they would take very careful care of our master tapes turned out that they were just kidding, and so finding, just tracking down proper masters of a lot of material that if it wasn't properly released, the masters are often very difficult to track down, because we would inevitably like keep copies for ourselves, and then like 2 months later we get a call and be like, we need another copy of that DAT because they can't find theirs, and it's like, but this is the only copy I've got. Oh, they'll send it back to you, you know, like over and over and over again. I, you know, all through the 80s and 90s, I very dutifully saved every master that we had, and half of those have been like are now in the warehouses of Rhino or eMusic or whoever dragged it all away. So I'm sorry to say that it wasn't me.
That's too bad. That always happens, I feel, with bands, that the master tapes get lost or are recorded over or whatever it is.
Yeah, yeah. It's very frustrating, and it was sort of foreseeable for me, but unfortunately there's only so much I could do.
I don't want to end this off on a melancholy note like that. That's too bad. What other pop songs? This is from Evan also. So we can end off on a happy note. Do you think you're going to add to your set list this year? Because you've been doing these retrospective set lists on the I Like Fun tour. So what do you think you want to add to the set list for this year? Looking forward.
Well, you know, we're doing all these shows in Australia where we're basically doing like the 80s versus the teens and the 90s versus the aughts. So recently been doing a bunch of songs off the very first album, but that was just sort of catch as catch can. There's no master plan, I can tell you that much. But there's a lot of material to choose from.
Mm-hmm. That's fantastic. Thank you so much for calling
in. Thank you for your time, and this is a fun one.
That's good to know. I'm glad we could come out the other end good.
All right, great. Talk to you soon.
Awesome. Thank you so much.